Welcome to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you, pulls it apart and weaves the facts back together in ways that are easy to understand. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're untangling redistricting in Ohio this season, the process of dividing our state into districts that determine who represent us in Congress and Columbus. Because all of us, all Ohio voters, are being asked to change how that process works.
Why do we have gerrymandering? It's because of politicians drawing the maps. Simple as that. We're not unique. Ohio is not unique. Other states in this country have wrestled with it. It's not a Democratic problem. It's not a Republican problem. It's a problem that resides with power, the establishment and the retention of political power. And all political parties are influenced by that.
That's former Ohio Chief Justice Maureen O'Connor. She's leading the charge to change how we draw our maps. Issue one would take redistricting away from those politicians and give it to 15 ordinary people, five Democrats, five Republicans, and five independents who have never run for public office. State Auditor Keith Faber thinks it's a terrible idea.
When you try and take politics out of an inherently political process, you end up with worse problems. And this organization is not apolitical. It has a very clear political leftist bent. They're all funded by the same funders. They all have the same support. And because they're not putting elected officials on there, doesn't mean they're not putting political people on there. I ask a rhetorical question. Who wants to serve on a redistricting commission if you have no interest in politics or no interest in political outcomes? Good luck finding people who have that model.
Ohio isn't the only state debating these ideas. Arizona, Michigan, and Iowa have all switched to an independent commission model. And we here at Untangled wanted to know how that's working out, how these states draw their maps. We begin in Arizona in the summer of 2011. Voters there had created their own commission and put two Republicans, two Democrats, and one independent who would function as a tiebreaker. That tiebreaker's name was Colleen Coyle Mathis, and she joins us now. Welcome to Untangled, Colleen.
Thank you for having me.
One of the first deciding votes that you made on Arizona's commission was to essentially pick which consultant, which map maker would do the drawing. And safe to say that Republicans in Arizona were not happy with your choice.
That's a fair assessment, Anna. Yes. So it was a key hire for us, as were our legal consultants. But hiring the mapping consultant, as it is in Arizona, we are truly five ordinary citizens, as it was referred to in the introduction. I don't have a mapping background. I'm not a lawyer. I am truly an ordinary citizen. I think during my interview, I had said I had worked at Dairy Queen growing up. I thought that was a pretty inconsequential kind of characteristic, and that truly is who I am. I didn't have a background in politics or anything. But our commission does have a lot of power in Arizona in that it can hire and fire whoever it wants to and doesn't answer to anyone on that topic. Our commission, in order to increase public confidence in the program, chose to actually use the state procurement office's process in order to hire and fire. We didn't have to do that, but we thought, gosh, you know, here's a tried and true process. Let's use that to hire our mapping and legal consultants. That ultimately didn't turn out to be the best decision because they have a kind of false scoring system where they also have a vote in who gets hired. So it didn't make sense really for our commission. I think if we had to do it again, none of the five commissioners would have opted to go that route. But nonetheless, that's what we did. And of the four that ultimately got interviewed, we chose the best mapping consultant by far. All mapping consultants have some kind of track record, hopefully, that you're hiring. And in our case, ours did have a track record with the Democratic Party. And
that's where things go off the rails.
Exactly. And so, yeah, people didn't like that, even though they were by far the best candidate that applied.
Yeah, they accused you of being a Democrat because your husband had once worked for one. They yelled. They came out in droves. I mean, this was, you know, 2011. This was right after the Tea Party midterm elections. Did you think it was going to get so political, so accusatory, so fast?
No, I didn't. And they selectively chose what they were unhappy about, because my husband also had worked for Republicans. He had, in fact, worked on Capitol Hill for Bob Michael, the former minority leader of the House of Representatives, a longtime leader there. He had also worked for Senator Chuck Hagel, a Republican. So they chose to choose the fact that he had worked for as a treasurer on a Democratic state candidate who ultimately wasn't successful in getting her seat. But regardless, it was crazy. And no, I didn't think it would get nearly as chaotic as it ultimately did.
Things escalated when Arizona's attorney general filed a lawsuit alleging that Colleen colluded with the Democrats on the commission to hire that mapping company. And this is where I want to bring in Dave Wells. He's a retired Arizona State University professor and a current research director for the Grand Canyon Institute, a public policy think tank that he co-founded in 2011. Dave, the attorney general bringing charges against anyone, it's serious. I mean, that's the power of the state being brought against an individual.
Yeah, and I mean, you have to keep in mind that the Republicans had a election wipeout in 20. I mean, they'd done really well in 2010. They actually
everywhere.
Only had eight. Yeah, they did it everywhere. And so we had actually in the state Senate, for instance, there were 22 Republicans and there were eight Democrats. I mean, they literally could fit in like a really small room together. So there is a really strong saying we had a full Republican control of all branches of government and offices at that time. So it became an extremely political thing, because what redistricting is it's very political, even if you try to put people who don't have a lot of political background on a commission.
And at one point, the Arizona State Senate removes Colleen as chair for alleged misconduct. She has to sue. She gets reinstated. And that kind of goes back to what you're saying. The vote was 21-6. So it was a Republican supermajority trying to get rid of her from this commission.
That's correct. Yeah. And again, fortunately, that didn't stand up. We had our Supreme Court, which at that time had 5 members on it, reinstated her, which was really, really critical, because I mean, the idea of an independent redistricting commission is that they can act independently outside of political influence. That doesn't mean that they aren't influenced by politics. I mean, in our particular district you actually have the head of the majority leader of the House and the Senate and the minority leader of the House and the Senate each appoint a person on there. And of course, they're going to appoint somebody who has some kind of strong political leanings. And when you have a lot of polarization, as we increasingly have, it puts a lot of pressure on a person like Colleen, because she becomes that fifth deciding vote. And it's not an easy position for any person to be in. And there's a lot of consequences, for any decisions that she makes.
Yeah, Colleen, I mean, having your name dragged through the mud, being sued by the attorney general, all of that sounds deeply unpleasant. But you also faced threats. I understand at one point you boarded up the windows in your bedroom.
Yes. Unfortunately, that is what happened. It was the height of the Tea Party, as you had noted. They were very upset about the choice of the mapping consultant, and then they were upset about the choice of legal consultant, and ultimately realized these politicians were not in charge of the redistricting process, and decided that they needed to go after me, especially. So I think initially they thought about going after both the Democratic commissioners and me, but then ultimately just decided on me. A sitting state senator had essentially made a threat that got reported in the press about targets and comparing some of the commissioners, myself being the one, as a target, and using a shooting analogy. And that's when that really got my husband's attention. And we decided to go to the to Washington, to the Department of Justice, and report on this ourselves, because we felt like no one was going to protect us in Arizona. So that's what we did.
And for context, This suggestion that you had a target on your back came just a couple of months after the Gabby Giffords shooting. For those who don't remember, Congresswoman Gabby Giffords and 18 others were shot in a Tucson supermarket parking lot in January of 2011. Six people died, including a 9-year-old girl. And then just a couple of months later, somebody says you have a target on your back. I cannot imagine what that had to feel like.
Yeah, you're exactly right, Anna. Thanks for mentioning that context, because it is important. That is the environment in which we were serving. And the meetings were always very tense and heightened. We were always in public, all of our meetings, which is what independent redistricting should be. It should be a process where the public gets involved and expresses their desires around redistricting. So all of our meetings were in public, yet it was a very heightened, tense environment. And so we ultimately, you know, had to start choosing places where we felt safe and have magnetometers and things like that. So I don't want to dissuade Ohio from doing this because it is the best way to go. I can guarantee it. And I would still do it all over again in a heartbeat. But you do have to take, you know, precautions, unfortunately, in any, you know, setting these days, unfortunately.
Dave, I've been thinking a lot about this idea because we're going to have 5 independent or unaffiliated voters on our commission. But unaffiliated doesn't mean you are in the middle. Like, that may be true in Colleen's case. We haven't talked about where she sits ideologically, but it just means you aren't registered with a major political party. I wonder, Dave, do you think it's unavoidable that whoever sits in those seats will just get extra scrutiny?
Oh, yes, it's really because you're going to be clear. You got 5 Republicans and 5 Democrats, and then the pressure will be on those 5 independents, which is and then, you know, exactly how they actually lean. I mean, a lot of it depends on like how open minded everybody is. But the challenge is that there's so much at stake with these seats. I mean, so in the Ohio context, OK, you currently have I'm going to use Congress as an example, but because you have 12 of your 15 seats are Republicans. And so it's 80%. That's clearly a gerrymandered outcome because that doesn't represent the totality of how Ohio tends to vote. By contrast, Arizona has, right now we have 6 Republicans and 3 Democrats. Previously we've had like 5 Democrats and 4 Republicans. But so there's a lot at stake. And if you think about the U.S. House of Representatives, how these gets drawn could affect who has a majority in the House of Representatives. In Arizona, it also affects which party potentially will have a majority now in the Senate and the House, because it's become really close. It's 31-29 in our House and 16-14 in our Senate. So the stakes are really huge. Essentially, it's a lot about drawing lines, is about choosing your voters as opposed to voters choosing your politicians. And it's really critical that be done with an open mind, with people who can dialogue and talk to each other. But there, the pressure on them is going to be immense because the stakes are actually really immense.
Colleen, what advice would you have for someone from Ohio who might consider applying if we were to pass issue 1? Like, I guess, what do you wish you knew before you signed up to serve?
Well, great question. I think what Dave said is really important, to be open-minded and to, you know, to the extent you can be as much like a judge as possible and try to, you know, be fair and listen to both sides. I think, you know, having the ability to listen and truly, you know, not just pretend listening, but actually listen and try to understand where people are coming from and find that common ground. I think that is where, you know, it is about compromise, I think. And I know that, you know, things have gone away from compromise, even though that's what our country was founded on. But to the extent you can find that common ground and get to know each other as people, I think that was really, really important. And unfortunately, because of the open meeting law in Arizona, that is not something our commission was ever really able to do. And it was really at the advice of our legal counsel, which I'm sure was right ultimately, because, you know, we were sued at almost every turn, and we would have been sued. And I was sued on open meeting law violations that were unfounded. And I won the case, but still, in order to understand people, you have to get to know them. And I really wanted to do that. I wanted each of us to have relationships with each other. But unfortunately, in that environment, it just wasn't prudent to do so because of the open meeting law.
One of the One of the arguments Arizona Republicans made against the maps that you drew, or that the commission drew, was they over-prioritized competitiveness, that after creating two majority Hispanic districts, which satisfy the Voting Rights Act, the other five congressional seats sort of leaned Republican until the commission gerrymandered them into toss-ups. Dave, can you kind of unpack that? So this idea of, like, you're intentionally making them too competitive.
Well, I mean, that's the challenge. Just to be honest, most districts are not going to be competitive. That's the way where people live. The way gerrymandering works is called packing and cracking. So essentially you pack, and our voting rights districts are illustrations of this. We pack a lot of, in Arizona's case, Hispanic voters together to create super majorities, which are super Democratic districts. The other thing you can do is you crack a district. Austin, Texas is an example of where when Texas Republicans redrew that they actually divided that city, which would be Democratic, into three Republican districts. So the challenge you have is trying to balance all those things. And there's a number of different things that you have to put together in it. But a lot of voters would like to see more competitive elections. And they also want to see overall outcomes that are more representative of the state as a whole. Like, so when I would teach political science, I'd often use North Carolina as an example. Could have used Ohio, I guess, but because North Carolina and Arizona both voted about 3.5% for Trump in 2016. Yet at that time, Arizona had five Democrats and four Republicans in Congress, and North Carolina had 10 Republicans and three Democrats in Congress. And it's those kind of discontinuities where things are so off that I think ultimately it's what redistricting is all fundamentally about. It's fundamentally about, I think, what the founders would have felt. I mean, they didn't expect we'd have political parties, much less gerrymandering. So I mean, I think this is a really important component here.
Yeah, because competitiveness, if a district is 70-30 and you make it 60-40 or 55-45, Colleen, you've made that district more competitive, but that's not how the commission interpreted competitiveness in Arizona.
Well, you know, there are a number of criteria that we have to follow that are laid out in our Arizona Constitution. And a lot of them are the standard redistricting criteria that all states follow. But Arizona does have this other one that we are to favor competitive districts when there's no detriment to other goals. And if you look at Proposition 106, which is what brought independent redistricting to Arizona, it's what the voters read in the voting booth when they, you know, were voting and whether, you know, deciding whether or not to have independent redistricting. And Proposition 106 was to oversee the mapping of fair and competitive districts. So that was literally in the voting booth in the language of the proposition. So to me, I used that as my guidepost in terms of, okay, this is what voters voted on. This is what they wanted. There had been independent redistricting for 10 years prior to my commission too. So it came to pass in 2000. Arizona was kind of a pioneer in this field. So competitiveness, it's not only in the, you know, preamble, so to speak, of the proposition, it's also one of the criteria we have to factor. However, the first commission in Arizona did get sued on this. They were charged with not valuing competitiveness enough. And so the Arizona Supreme Court ultimately ruled that all the criteria are to be weighed equally. That is how they interpreted the language. And so we had the benefit of that interpretation, knowing that, okay, we have to weigh all these equally, even though they compete with each other. And that's the trick, is even though you weigh them all equally, you cannot apply them all equally. It is impossible to do so. So as much as I would like to see as much competitiveness injected as possible, I'm a political independent, and ideologically speaking, I was a Republican, you know, from age 18. I grew up in a red district, Peoria, Illinois, in a blue state. And ultimately, though, became an independent even when I still lived in Illinois. And when I moved to Arizona over 20 years ago, I came in as an independent. So I've really never subscribed to either party. I really vote for the candidate. So I know the ideological piece came up earlier. And despite what people may say about me, that is the truth. And so, you know, that competitiveness criterion to me, yes, I do. I'm biased towards it. I like, I think inherently Americans like competition. It's a good thing in almost every aspect, whether it's, you know, business or sports or redistricting. But Dave's right. There's only so much you can do. The Voting Rights Act, you know, is working against you, as well as sorting or clustering, as it's called, where, you know, like-minded people tend to live together. And there's only so much you can do when you're dealing with those two giant pieces of redistricting criterion. So there's only so many, you know, Democrats, so to speak, left over to work with when you've created two majority-minority districts, as you noted, Anna.
Colleen, Dave, thank you so much for your time this morning.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Glad to join you.
Yeah. Coming up, we're moving from Arizona to that nameless state up north, and how their mapmakers found themselves in violation of federal law. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Untangled, a show from All Sides and WOSU that takes a complicated topic and untangles it for you. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're untangling redistricting in Ohio this season. And today we're taking a trip across the country, learning how independent commissions in other states draw their maps.
Our top story this morning, the boundaries of 13 Detroit area seats in the Michigan legislature have to be redrawn.
That is the ruling from a three-judge panel after finding the map was illegally influenced by race.
That's a clip from Detroit Channel 7 in December, when a federal court tossed out 13 districts drawn by their independent commission. They said they'd violated the Federal Voting Rights Act by combining black voters in Detroit with too many of their white suburban neighbors, a move that resulted in black Democrats losing political primaries. Lauren Gibbons is a state government reporter for Bridge Michigan, the state's largest nonprofit news service. She followed the first independent redistricting process from conception to completion, and she joins us now. Lauren, let's back up a moment. Michigan's redistricting commission is set up similar, but not identical to what's being proposed in Ohio. But the criteria your mapmakers have to look at are pretty close to what we might be looking at. Compact, contiguous, reflect communities of interest, ensure partisan fairness. How did that all play out in 2021 when they started to wrangle these different ideas?
Yeah, it was a really interesting process here in Michigan. And I think communities of interest was one of the things that really was the most ambiguous of what we were looking at here in Michigan, and one of the most ultimately controversial. So that was one thing that sort of tied up commissioners here as they were looking into stuff. But as you mentioned, too, one of the biggest points of contention was how to divvy up Metro Detroit. There was also a big Voting Rights Act factor in the room, and they had differing opinions on how to address that. Their legal counsel ultimately said, we probably shouldn't talk about it very much in public because we could be violating the Voting Rights Act if we draw districts based on race. And ultimately, the court found that they did end up drawing Detroit districts based on the racial makeup of these different districts. So those were the two biggest things that came up again and again around the state as they finished drawing the maps. The other like geographics and, you know, partisan fairness was something that came up quite a bit in Michigan as well. But ultimately, when push came to shove, it was Voting Rights Act issues, and also what are communities of interest?
Yeah, we talked about that in our last episode. How do you draw a fair map? Because is a school district, you could argue that is a community of interest. Mm-hmm. Is a township, you could argue that. What about, like, we all go to the same church or belong to the same employer, or a string of communities along a lakefront? They all have lakefront issues. It's not as straightforward as one would think.
And to give an example here in Michigan, one of the districts in the state Senate that was brought up in the lawsuit, in this district, there was a piece of Detroit, a pretty working class, majority minority area, extending into as far as Birmingham, Michigan, which is a affluent, majority white suburb. And a lot of critics of the maps were asking, why are these two communities together? There is no interest except for the Woodward Avenue cuts straight through it, which is a big road up here in Michigan, coming out of Detroit into some of these other suburb communities. So that was one example and something that was brought up again and again in trying to adjust these maps to make them more politically fair statewide. There were instances where they said, hey, you know, there's not really a underlying community of interest here.
There was lots of vitriol in Arizona for their lone independent commissioner. Did you see any of that in Michigan? Was there any questioning the loyalty of the people on the commission?
Oh, certainly. There were five independent commissioners and then four who were aligned with either political party. And particularly when some of the lawsuits started coming, when you started seeing a lot of contention, even among certain members of the commission, there were questions about allegiances and sort of infighting. Ultimately, there weren't any situations where a commissioner was kicked off because of whether they were independent or not, although it was attempted a few times, actually, here in Michigan. So that was certainly an issue that critics brought up. How do you determine if someone is truly independent? And there wasn't really a great answer.
Yeah, I think it's a really difficult question. But ultimately, what happened when you had your first elections in 2022 with these new maps? Because it looks like the legislature got pretty blue, or it's split more blue than it's been in a long time.
Yeah, Michigan's state House and state Senate political districts had long been skewed toward Republicans, although at the statewide level in gubernatorial or Senate races, we've had, for example, Democratic state senators for decades, but then the legislature was typically going Republican. And part of that was because of the way the districts were drawn. And what happened after they drew these maps, and although as I mentioned, the Metro Detroit maps did change a little bit after a court order, it didn't fundamentally change what happened, which is that the state house is extremely, extremely competitive. The way that they're drawn, it could go either way towards Democrats or Republicans, depending on which party fares better statewide. And then in the Senate, it's still very competitive as well, but slightly Democratic leaning. So both parties in 2022 took, or excuse me, both Democrats took both chambers of the legislature in 2022. The state house is up again this year, so they are defending that. And like I said, the state house is extremely competitive. It could go either way. There are a couple of very, very close political districts, and it is a result of these maps fundamentally.
Well, I mean, Michigan, the state, could go either way in the U.S. presidential election, so that probably tracks.
Yes, definitely. It is very much a battleground state, and redistricting ultimately made it a battleground legislature as well.
But it did, for the first time in nearly 70 years, Detroit, which is nearly four-fifths Black, it didn't elect a Black congressperson. They elected an Indian-born businesswoman who beat out eight Black opponents in a Democratic primary. And this is part of what led to that lawsuit that ultimately results in those districts being struck down.
Yeah, and just to clarify, the congressional districts did not change as a result of the lawsuit. It was the state legislature, but there was a lot of concern, as you mentioned, when Sri Tanadar got elected in Detroit, that resulted in no Black Democrats getting elected to Congress. There were a couple of other factors related to that, and one of them is what you mentioned, that he had so many opponents in that first election cycle that kind of split
A
up
nine-way
the black
primary is
vote.
huge.
Yes, definitely. It was a very competitive primary, and he had by far the most money. This election cycle, it was interesting because he did have a pretty well-liked, well-funded challenger in Adam Ollier. He ultimately was kicked off the ballot because he had issues with his petition signatures, so he did not qualify. The candidate who came forward as sort of the replacement challenger did make some inroads. She was a Black city council member, but did not ultimately overcome some of the other challenges. So that was part redistricting, but also part just the dynamics of the district.
So opponents of issue one, which is our ballot measure that we're going to be voting on in November, say the same thing would happen here. We actually had an anti-issue one press event in Columbus the other week, and an ex-Michigan state rep named Sherry Gay Dinyogo predicted that if we do what you did, we will ultimately just have fewer black lawmakers.
And that is really interesting. Sherry, a former state rep, was very critical of Michigan's process, particularly as it came to Metro Detroit area. And it's hard to say exactly how it would go, just because when you put all of these independent citizen, non-lawmakers, non-politicians, non-lobbyists in a room together, it's a little hard to predict what might come out of it. And I think here in Michigan, we saw they were pretty heavily influenced by a specific legal counsel, a specific view that was ultimately struck down in court. And I think, regardless of, we've seen in many states, not just Michigan, right, where there were legal challenges, there were concerns with what came out. But I personally am very curious to see how the second round goes. We saw the highs, we saw the lows. It's when they insert a new crop of people, it could go a completely different way. But I do think it's a fair point that she has. She watched what happened in Detroit, and certainly there could be concern that any interpretation of the Voting Rights Act could have larger implications for other states too.
Ultimately, the districts were redrawn. You have a new set for 2024. What was the reaction of the commissioners to this loss? Do they simply chalk it up to we made a mistake, we got some bad advice, we changed who were we consulting with? Like, what was the fallout?
It really depended on the commissioner. I think a lot of the commissioners ultimately did think that they came up with the best products that they could at the time. There were certainly members of the commission who wanted to change or questioned how Detroit was drawn when the initial map was adopted, and were very, very open to the court coming in and saying, we need to change this. Ultimately, the commission as a whole decided, well, this is what the court said. We have to do what the court did. And you saw after the court got involved and some new parameters were set around the process. When you were going to these public hearings and listening to what voters had to say, a lot of the criticism did go away. They said, well, it seems like these new maps fixed the problem. It didn't really change the partisan fairness aspect statewide a whole ton. So I think once the glaring spotlight of federal courts came into play, commissioners did buckle up and get a new set of maps for Metro Detroit together.
What is the reaction among Michiganders? Like, when you talk to people in your reporting and just maybe even your personal life, I don't know if you talk redistricting on your days off, but what did they make of the commission and the 2022 elections and how it's working out?
Yeah, I think now, certainly when it was happening, people would ask me a lot, even in my personal life, but also in my professional life, it became something because it was such a complicated issue. People are like, what does this mean for me? What does this mean for my community? And whether it comes down to, are my districts going to change? Is it going to matter? And I think in the subsequent election cycles, certainly all eyes were on Detroit in 2022. Now in 2024, There is still a little interest, but overall, I think a lot of people just accepted what happened and have moved on. It's a little hard to get people in Michigan interested in redistricting updates, a little harder than it was when they were going through the mapping process. But overall, I'll say, while there is still a lot of concern, about how things went down, I think there is acknowledgement it would be very hard to change the Constitution at this point. So there's a little acknowledgement, well, it would be nice to fix some of these issues. Maybe some of it just has to be from the ground up or the rulemaking process, because going back to the voters would be really hard at this point.
Never say never. We're voting for the fifth time in 20 years. So, but that was Lauren Givens with Bridge Michigan. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Coming up, we're landing in our final destination, the state Governor Mike DeWine wants us to emulate, Iowa. That's when Untangled continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to Untangled. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Governor Mike DeWine wants to change how Ohio draws its political maps. He says our current system didn't work the way anyone wanted it to in 2021. But he also wants Ohioans to reject issue one this November, saying that method of drawing maps won't work either.
There must be a better way. And there is a better way. I believe the Iowa system provides us with an example of a system that takes politics out of map drawing. Map draws are, under the Iowa plan, prohibited. They are prohibited from looking at past voting patterns. The Iowa system is clean. It is simple and has been used successfully to achieve the good government objectives that we all associate with true reform.
O.K. Henderson is Radio Iowa's news director and been covering map-making process in the Hawkeye State for decades. Kay, our governor has been singing your state's praises, so I appreciate you joining us to explain how it all works over there.
Glad to be here.
I want to begin with what mapmakers in Iowa are prohibited from doing, because you've got quite the list. Mapmakers can't look at where politicians live. They can't look at party registration, previous election results, or any real demographic information outside of race if it were to relate to the Voting Rights Act. What is the purpose of all these prohibitions?
Well, one of the purposes is to follow the edicts of the Iowa Supreme Court. If we could get back in the Wayback Machine here.
Sure.
One reason Iowa wound up with this system is the U.S. Supreme Court in 1962 said individuals could sue over redistricting plans. And then in 1968, Iowa voters adopted an amendment which said that Iowa's district lines should be based on population. Up until that point, they were based on geography. So every county in Iowa, there are 99 of them, had at least one representative in the Iowa House of Representatives, and then some of the larger counties had two. And so it was supposed to be the writing in 1971, and by the way, I didn't cover 1971, I'm not that old. But in 1971, maps were drawn according to population. And then the Iowa Democratic Party, the Iowa Federation of Labor, and the ACLU of Iowa, and the League of Women Voters sued because they found out that the maps had been gerrymandered to favor Republicans. So the map that was used in the 1970s was actually written by the Iowa Supreme Court, and then it laid out these standards. So for congressional maps, you have to have counties as a whole, and they have to be very close to the population. So for example, the 2011 maps that were adopted, the population deviation between districts 1, 2, 3, and 4, the greatest deviation was 150 people, which is sort of amazing.
Yeah.
And then other factors when you're developing the legislative maps, as you mentioned, they can't adhere to any of the list of things that you mentioned. They must, as much as possible, keep cities as a whole. They can divide a city, but they can't divide it in multiple ways. If it can be divided in two, it's to be divided in two. If it can be divided in three, it can be divided in three. And then some rural areas outside can be included. But those are just some of the ways that the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency drafts the maps.
Let's talk about that. You have the Nonpartisan Legislative Services Agency, or LSA, as the map maker. So we have a similar set of Capitol staffers here in Ohio. We call them LSC, so Legislative Services Commission. But so slightly different name, but these are nonpartisan full-time employees at the State House. And so they draw your maps, and then they give them to the legislature to approve or reject, correct?
Correct.
And then what happens if they reject the maps?
Well, this system in Iowa has what's called Plan 1, Plan 2, and Plan 3.
Oh.
So Plan 1 is presented to the public, and then there is a citizen board, but the citizen board's only responsibility is to hold public hearings about the plan, and then the legislature votes. So Plan 1, the legislature can only approve or reject it. If they reject it, then Plan 2 is drawn. They can only reject Plan 2, and to get to Plan 3, Plan 3 can be amended in any way by the legislature. If they can't do that by September 15th, then the Iowa Supreme Court takes over again and it draws the maps.
Oh. So then the court can always step in and...
Correct.
You can also sue over these, right? The appeal will go directly to the court.
Right, exactly.
But one thing I do want to keep in mind when we're discussing Iowa and whether an Iowa plan could work in Ohio, which is not what's being proposed here for November, but Iowa doesn't have enough concentrated minority populations to really need to consider the Voting Rights Act, correct?
That is correct.
And that in some ways makes it easier because you don't have to take into consideration certain demographic data.
Correct.
Have you guys ever gotten to a map where the legislature made amendments and just changed it? Has that ever actually happened?
Well, the Iowa Supreme Court in the 1970s said, we're going to draw the maps. And in 1980, the Iowa legislature adopted this plan, the Plan 1, Plan 2, Plan 3. So then when the Iowa legislature got census data in 1981, they did go all the way to Plan 3.
Oh.
Which is the one they could have amended, but they didn't.
Okay.
In 1999, they adopted Plan 1. They said, great. Let's do it. In 2001, they adopted Plan 2. In 2011, they adopted Plan 1. And then in 2021, they adopted Plan 2, but they adopted it in late October. As you may remember, the Census Bureau had a hard time delivering the census data to states. And so everything was truncated. And the Iowa Supreme Court said, hey, we know you're supposed to get this done by September 15th. But we're just going to stand aside and let the legislative process work. And so they had set sort of a deadline of the end of the year in 2021 for the legislature to get its ducks in a row. And as I mentioned, they selected Plan 2.
What I find fascinating about that is the legislature's never gone in and actually amended and changed a plan, which is something that I hear from people who don't want to do an Iowa plan here, is that, oh, the, you know, the party in power will just come in and they will just amend Plan 3 however they want and none of this will work. And why do you think that doesn't happen in Iowa?
Well, one of the things that a former legislative leader of one party and another former legislative leader of another party told me after the 2011 redrawing was that by the time you're that many decades into this process, there really isn't the muscle memory of how to amend the plan. And so everybody has to relearn everything. I mean, you mentioned at the onset that one of the things these plans cannot consider is where legislators live.
Oh, that's true.
So the political parties actually get this plan from the Nonpartisan Services Agency, and then they have to put it into a computer program that the Republican Party buys and separately the Democratic Party buys to figure out which legislators are thrown together in which districts, which is really fascinating. And so, as I recall from the 2021 plan that was adopted, there were 58 members of the Iowa legislature that would have had to run against another incumbent or perhaps two other incumbents in their district if they wanted to seek re-election.
Oh my goodness, that's a lot of head-to-head.
Right.
That's like exactly. A majority of the chamber.
Exactly. And the other factor that I think people don't consider outside of Iowa is that, of course, the members of Congress look at this and they have, you know, a stake in this because the last map that was adopted threw two incumbent Republicans into the same district. But what happened was that the legislators really don't care about the congressional maps. They care about their maps. And so it's all that internal politicking at the state level that really decides this. And, you know, I've, as mentioned earlier, I've covered this for many years. There was a congressman in Southwest Iowa who put up pretty much of a stern warning to legislators if they approved a map that basically covered the entirety of Iowa's southern border and sort of stretched up into central Iowa. He hated the district, and it wound up that, and he talked about how much he hated the district. Well, he wound up having to run in that district.
That's awkward.
Exactly.
You know, your map makers are handcuffed in another way that I find really fascinating is that there are limits on the size of the data that map makers can use to build districts. So, like, when you get census data, it comes in different sizes, and, like, there's really small and really big ones. And I've kind of been thinking about it like blocks. Like, if I was going to build a brick wall out of Legos versus regular, you know, human-sized bricks, like, I would have thousands more combinations with the Legos than I would with the bricks. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, because I heard one of your guys from LSA talk about it, and I was like, oh, that's fascinating. They also, like, have rules about data size.
Right. So I mentioned previously that Iowa has 99 counties. So when the person is drawing the congressional maps, they have to use every one of those 99 counties as a block, as you mentioned. They can't divide up a county. How many counties does Ohio have?
88.
So you would have to use 88 different blocks under the Iowa plan to draw the congressional maps, number one. Number two, as I mentioned previously, cities have to be in one district unless they're outside of in legislative maps. Let's go down to the legislative level. We have 100 members of the Iowa House of Representatives, and we have 50 members of the Senate. So, you know, that would make sense that two House districts would equal one state Senate district. So when they're looking at that census data, they look at the cities. And if a city has enough population, they can't divide the city. It has to be in one legislative district. So that's kind of how they divide things.
Kay Henderson, thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Next week, our final episode of Untangled Redistricting drops, and it's the one you've been waiting for. We're diving into issue one itself, hearing from those who want you to vote yes and those who want you to vote no. Because in the end, it's going to be up to us, the voters of Ohio, to decide who draws the maps. Thanks for listening, and make sure to tune in at 11, only on 89.7 NPR News.